professor of history at Buckingham University, and I've just written a book about George V. It's called George V, Never a Dull Moment.
Well, thank you for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today, and congratulations on being shortlisted for the History Reclaimed Book of the Year Award. Now, Professor Ridley, you are a distinguished historian, I read, and this isn't your first book about a British monarch. Tell me about your previous books first.
Well, yes, my books about monarchs, they didn't come about because, you know, I've always been interested in the history of monarchs, or this is what I always wanted to write about. It was almost sort of just accident. My first book, well, not my first book, but my first book about a monarch, was a biography of King Edward VII. Actually, the Edwardian period was the period that I was interested in and that I did my PhD in. And so he seemed a very appropriate monarch to write about, particularly when I discovered that nothing much had been done about him since the 1960s. So Edward VII was quite a big, fat book, but it was followed by a very small, thin book, because I was invited to do the volume on Queen Victoria in the Penguin Monarch series of books, which are all of them sort of 25, or I was allowed 30,000 words because she had such a long reign. So Queen Victoria, but very small. And then recently, George V, Never a Dull Moment, which is a biography largely about George V, but also contains a significant amount about his wife and consort, Queen Mary.
Yes, it's been called a dual biography about them both, the King and the Queen. But what made you write this book now, just in terms of it was the next natural step in terms of covering the monarchs? Or did you just have an intuitive feeling that George V, who was supposed to be the dullest monarch ever, really wasn't a dull monarch? How did you stumble across it all?
Well, I suppose initially my motive was just that I'd been writing about Edward VII and therefore had a certain amount to talk about and think about George V. And it seemed to me that not much had been done about him. Again, he hadn't had a major biography since the 1980s by Kenneth Rose. But then the more I sort of got into the topic, the more the whole question of George's alleged dullness and ordinariness came important and the thing that I wanted really to focus on. I mean, the thing that I found interesting, really, was he really dull, or should we make a distinction between being dull and being ordinary? Do you actually rather need to be ordinary in order to be a successful constitutional monarch in the 20th or 21st century? I don't think, really, that, you know, monarchs who have huge amounts of sort of, flamboyance or great collectors like Charles I or indeed George IV, they don't actually usually end up terribly good monarchs. And the more I looked at George V, the more it seemed to me that he was actually, as king, very successful, proactive, and steered both his country and the monarchy over some really quite bumpy times from 1910 to 1936, the period of his reign.
And of course, that period embraced the First World War, the rise of the Bolsheviks, the suffragettes, the Russian Revolution, and the first Labour government, which he is said to have assisted. So even though he might have traditionally been thought of as a dull monarch, he didn't reign over a dull time.
He certainly reigned in a really stressful time. I mean, you know, he became king sort of his father died very suddenly in 1910, at the height of the constitutional conflict over the powers of the House of Lords. He was just plunged into this incredibly complex political conflict without hardly any briefing at all, and he in fact made rather a mess of it. No sooner was that over than, you know, then it's home rule, and then along came the First World War, and the First World War created a kind of existential crisis for the European dynastic monarchies and empires. George V had the good luck that Britain was on the winning side, because most of the monarchs who were on the wrong side and who were defeated, or whose sort of war effort ran out of puff, as happened with Russia, the Russian Empire collapsed, the Kaiser's Empire collapsed, and of these cousins, George was the only one that stayed standing.
And some might put his ordinariness, as you rephrase it, not dullness, as a reason why the monarchy still stands today, because he is, of course, the Queen's grandfather. But if we have a look at his attributes, should we call them, he was known for doing nothing but killing animals and collecting stamps. He wore the same collar stud, I think, throughout his life, compared to his wife, Queen Mary. As I said, it's said to be a rather engaging dual biography of them both. But she was slightly more captivating because she liked nice jewellery. The jewellery weighed down her clothing. She liked fine food. He liked plain food. I mean, how do you go about researching them both?
Gosh, yes, that's a good question. Basically, you have to get access, or at least I felt I had to get access, to the Royal Archives. You know, it's a huge amount of material generated by George during George's reign. So the book took me a long time to write. It took about 7 years. Of course, I wasn't doing it all the time. I was teaching as well. Almost half that time was taken up by researching in the Royal Archives mainly. And it's a wonderful place to work. You're in this marvellous round tower in Windsor Castle, and, you know, at sort of in the middle of the morning, 11 or something, the changing of the guard and all sorts of soldiers stamping and shouting downstairs. You look out the window, this wonderful view. It is a marvellous place with an amazing archive. It's quite a slow process. And I always feel with these kind of books, you have to do the basic archive before you really start writing. You have to get through the salt mines. So George's papers were there. And then I did actually manage to discover the archives, the transcripts of Queen Mary's archive, which were made by her biographer, Pope Hennessy. A lot of that material was in America. And so I was able to photograph that, which was rather quicker than typing out stuff in the Royal Archives. Basically, once you start writing, you start, I find, getting a whole new set of questions and having to do more research in different places. So it's a very long, drawn-out process. But the great thing of this being a dual biography is that I was able to talk about the relationship between George and Mary. And I always think that if you've got a good sort of marriage going on and a conversation between husband and wife, this is, it's very helpful to making the book sort of be readable and characterising them. It's very helpful too.
And this pheasant-shooting king and bejewelled queen, during this, if you like, you might call it a turbulent time at the beginning of the 20th century, were they boring or dull or ordinary? Did they provide in some way a stability for the monarchy that was lacking in society?
Yes, well, first of all, certainly it was an incredibly turbulent time. Constitutional crisis, etc., before the war. The war itself, the biggest loss of life that we've ever had, this country in war. The sort of post-war economic depression, strikes, the general strike, and then the great crash. Altogether, a thoroughly turbulent time. And I think that one sort of thing, interesting thing that happens to the perception of the monarchy is that before George V's reign, in the reign of his father, Edward VII has a very glamorous court, and it is very closely linked to the aristocracy. Under George V, particularly in the 1920s after the First World War, the monarchy is not fashionable. You know, London society is run by the great sort of hostesses like Emeril Cunard, who are not friends of the king and queen particularly. But the monarchy is reinvented by George and Mary, particularly by George, to be a sort of domestic family monarch, a family on the throne. People talk about the family firm. And it's this sort of ordinariness that is cultivated by George. And certainly, I think this does act as a sort of stabilizing factor in the interwar period. And also, some people thought, there's one interesting article I read by Attlee, the Labour leader, that because George himself was such a popular figure, a hero to his people, and also somebody who goes into his people's homes, in the sense of, you know, his wireless broadcast, his Christmas broadcast, and they felt they knew him. He was the grandfather of the nation. This meant that there was no room for a kind of fascist dictator such as Mosley to gain the support of the people. In that sense, too, I think George's reign as king is important in stabilising the country.
Now, when you were in those archives, and you make them sound very appealing, sitting there for 7 years, you started out clearly by reading previous books about George V, and he was thought, as we said, to be dull. But what stories are your favourite stories that you stumbled across that made you think, aha, as a biographer, I can rewrite this history. He's more engaging as a king than we ever thought. The stories that you stumbled across, are there any that stand out?
I think one thing that does stand out is his ability, particularly later on in the second half of his reign, his ability to sort of laugh at himself, almost as if he sort of created a persona of himself, which he's playing up to. For example, with the stamp collecting, which is a difficult thing to empathise with, because unless one's particularly interested in it, which I'm afraid I'm not, you know, it's very easy to sort of scoff and say, here was this king spending 2 or 3 hours a week, which he was during the First World War, with his stamps, in his stamp room, his dedicated stamp room at Buckingham Palace, with his stamp, the sort of master of his stamp collection. It all sounds, you know, a bit sort of eccentric, to say the least. But I think that, well, first of all, the stamp collection he managed to create was one of the best in the world. So when he did try to do something, he did it really well. But there was a nice story about a really famous stamp, which is called a Blue Mauritius, which is one of the first stamps to be created. And I've seen the actual stamp. They're very, very rare, these Blue Mauritius stamps. To the uneducated eye, such as mine, they seem very sort of, you know, coarse, just a small blue tiny square in the middle of which is pasted into the middle of a large album. Blue Mauritius was the most expensive, most sought after stamp at that time amongst stamp collectors. And there was an article in the newspaper which some courtier talked about to the king. And the courtier said, some damn fool gave £1,400 for one stamp. And the king replied, I was the damn fool. So this ability to laugh at himself, I think, is quite appealing. The other thing that he really didn't understand or have any sort of conception of the significance of was modern art. And so there's a story of the king stumping around some gallery and he stops in front of a particularly modern-looking painting, and he shouts out, look, May, he always called the Queen May, here's something to make you laugh. And, of course, it was a Cézanne. So it's that sort of almost sort of jokey philistinism, an ability to laugh at his own philistinism, which I did find increasingly rather endearing.
And people did also point out that he liked, apart from the stamps, killing animals. I think when he went to India, he was shooting tigers and elephants, but he might be called a character in modern times. Do you think that's a good depiction of him? Something that, although we might not like these things now, they were things that people could relate to.
Shooting was elite sport. I mean, it was something that rich people did. And we are staggered today by the amount of birds that they shot, the amount of birds that they killed. And he would, as his diary showed, he would shoot 100 days in a year. Remember, you're only allowed to shoot from August until the end of January. So within those months, it's almost a full-time occupation. But again, as with the stamp collecting, he does it incredibly well. I think to be a really good shot, you have to be naturally very well balanced and athletic and, you know, hand-eye coordination, all that kind of stuff. And that certainly he was. So he was among those sort of top six game shots in Britain at that time. And of course, today we have different views about shooting so many birds. You know, given the sort of attitudes at the time, I think in a way his shooting is rather interesting because it does show us just what a perfectionist he was. If he was going to do something, he was jolly well going to be the best at whatever that thing might be, stamps or bird shooting.
And did you like him as a character and Queen Mary too? We need to say a little more about her because she was just known to be, as I said, this bejeweled queen. Did she have more to her?
Oh, Queen Mary certainly did. And Queen Mary was much more articulate. And George wrote some nice letters, some good letters, particularly to her and to his mother. But on the whole, his letters are a bit stylized. But Queen Mary was much more engaged with people. I found her actually very, very fascinating and very sympathetic. I mean, if George's problem is perceived as being dull, which I don't think is right, there's also Queen Mary's issue. She was perceived as being a kleptomaniac. And there are all these stories about, you know, Queen Mary, she had a passion for going around country houses. She'd invite herself to people's houses to have a look. If she saw an ornament or a clock or a painting that she liked, she would be very sort of effusive in admiring it. People interpreted this as meaning that actually she was asking to be given it. And so all these stories grew up about how when Queen Mary came to tea, you had to hide all the Fabergé or whatever it might be that was valuable, and that she had this huge collection, etc., etc. And I think that really it might have happened once or perhaps, but I think it was very largely gossip. I think that people interpreted her words, which were meant to be sort of just admiring something, into being a command that the thing should be given to her. And it led to all sorts of embarrassments. But I think she thought really really that things that were royal or had once been royal should be in royal possession. But otherwise, I really don't think. I think it's completely exaggerated to think that she wanted to collect all these things. The thing about Queen Mary was she was a brilliant collector and curator. And in the royal collection today, you know, her name is fated because she basically was the founder of the royal collection. She went round all the furniture at Windsor. You can imagine all the sort of old furniture from past reigns, sort of in storerooms, etc. She got people to identify it. She herself was quite good at knowing what furniture was what. And she also added to the royal collections wherever she could. She had a passion for shopping. She adored antique shops. And she was interesting. And in fact, but they seemed a very mismatched couple in a way because, you know, she really hated going shooting. Last thing she wanted to do was stand in a muddy field. But nevertheless, they did work as a couple. And the fact, this strong marriage, I think, was really crucial to his success as king. He would always discuss, she would know everything before anybody else knew about politics. They operated, well, in rather a modern way, actually, as a couple. He certainly respected her intelligence.
And what do you think, if we take an overarching view of their reign and this dual biography, what do you think their legacy to British society and the English monarchy is today?
Well, I think that the legacy to the English monarchy is that, to a large extent, the Queen's monarchy follows that of her grandfather, George V. I mean, in a sense, he can be described as the founder of the modern monarchy, a monarchy which celebrates virtues like ordinariness, as we were talking about, and a monarchy which, for better or for worse, consists of a family, the family firm, a family together sharing the sort of functions of the monarchy. So I think that George's legacy can be seen there very clearly. And of course, there is also the thing about that kind of monarchy is that the family has to get on. If there's a rift, if there's a quarrel, that is very divisive, not just at the human level, but at the level of the institution. George V had very bad relations with his eldest son, Edward VIII, Duke of Windsor. And the rift that grew between Edward VIII and George V was, I think, a key factor in the abdication. It basically meant that Edward VIII was not prepared to be a monarch in the same way as he observed his father was. He didn't think he could do that job. He didn't want that job. And so, you know, after a few months, he basically quit, with, of course, also the thing that's so important to monarchy, the conflict between love and duty. Edward VIII obviously abandons his duty, which is to be king, in order to marry a woman he loves, which is Wallis Simpson.
It seems to me, Professor Ridley, that you liked these characters in terms of your 7 years of research and writing, that you had an insight into their characters that previous biographers didn't. Is it right to say that you have to like the characters you write about historically?
Sometimes one finds that I like the characters more as time goes on, and sometimes I like them less. And it's much better if you like them more. I mean, one character I really found I didn't like, and I found I liked him less and less the more, well, the older he got and the more I read about him, was Edward VIII. I mean, he was just so self-obsessed, thoughtless, almost sort of some kind of personality disorder. He changed his mood so quickly, and it could be completely charming and then vile. I found him very unattractive. His father and mother, George and Mary, I found more and more to admire about them and to be interested too. I think the question of like is for whether you like the subject that you're writing a biography about. It is a difficult question. I think, obviously, if you loathe them, it's going to be difficult for the book to write the book, and it's not going to come out well. But I think that the really important thing when you're writing a biography is not being bored by the subject. If your subject turns out to be dull all the way through, all the time, then I'm afraid it's not a book that you want to write. You need a subject that will engage you. This is what I found with both, and surprisingly with George, who was sort of condemned for his dullness. I found that he became increasingly engaging and a sort of wily old thing as he got older.
And as I said, that myth about Queen Mary too, taking the jewels, that's a real revelation. Can I just mention one more George V story in your book, Never a Dull Moment? His death apparently was brought on prematurely by the doctor so that it could be reported in the Times in the morning rather than the London evening papers. Is that correct?
Well, yes, it is correct, I think. And we know about it because the doctor kept a detailed notebook about what he did. And so this is 1936, and George V is suffering from really something that he's been increasingly incapacitated since 1928, when he had a bad chest infection and an abscess, and he nearly died because they couldn't find the source of the infection. He was only survived because the doctor sort of had one last look and managed to find this huge abscess on the king's lung and to drain it. So he recovered from that, but he continued to have very poor health increasingly after that. I mean, the basic problem was smoking too much. Of course, nobody knew in those days about the medical effects of smoking. So George continues to puff away, and after New Year, 1936, it's quite evident that he's become suddenly very ill. After he's been ill for about 3 weeks, the doctor, who's called Lord Dawson, decided that rather than let the king suffer and die a painful and undignified death, he was going to inject him with a lethal cocktail of morphia and cocaine. So these two injections into the king's jugular vein at 11 o'clock on the 20th of January, p.m. Within a quarter of an hour, the king is comatose and quiet, and he dies at 5 minutes to midnight. And this was the perfect timing that the doctor wanted in order to telephone through a message to the Times, where the presses are being held, waiting for the news about whether the king will live or not. So the news gets through, and the Times prints, I don't know how many thousand copies, which are ready on the breakfast tables of the middle classes in Britain the next morning, and so that the news doesn't get out in the less respectable press, sort of Evening Standards of the time, in the afternoon of the following day.
Well, that indeed is another one of those historical facts that you authenticated about George V. Just some quick fire questions before we end, and thank you for giving your time so generously, Professor Ridley. But did you get writer's block?
Well, I'm a very slow writer. I wasn't able to write as fast as I would like, and I never can. But no, I didn't actually get writer's block. Nobody's asked me that question before, and I was just thinking, no, there's such a huge amount of material, so sometimes it was a bit despairing whether I'd ever get to the end. Harold Nicholson, who wrote the official biography of George V in the 1950s, described writing his book at the beginning, starting at chapter one, King George V was born, etc. It was like getting in a taxi and going off to Vladivostok. It seemed such a long way to go. And I did get that feeling, but that's very different from writer's block. It's more sort of writer's panic. You've just got to get on and hurry up.
Another quick fire. Any crosswords with the publishers? Were they happy with the 7 years it took to write it?
They weren't happy, but they were very generous about it. They didn't cancel my contract, which I suppose, they could have. In fact, but what happened instead was the contract was constantly extended, and I knew I was being unrealistic each time and pretending I could finish it, and I couldn't. So I suppose my panics were not about writer's block, but they were about whether I'd be able to finish it and whether I would ever finish it. But there was plenty to write about. It was just taking all too long.
Well, then, in that case, the last quickfire question, another book in the offing. Are you working your way up chronologically to the next monarch in line to the throne now?
No, I'm not doing that. But I don't quite know what I am doing, but I'm having some thoughts, which is still sort of vague.
Professor Ridley, thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today about your book, George V, Never a Dull Moment, and of course, his wife, Queen Mary II, a dual biography, it's been called. I've really enjoyed talking to you and learning so much about this period of history. You've been shortlisted for the History Reclaimed Book Prize, so congratulations and fingers crossed.
Well, thank you so much, Bonnie. Thank you for a really enjoyable interview. Thank you. And also, thank you also for reading the book, which I can tell you have. It always makes me very happy. Thank you.
Well, thank you for writing it.